Hello, and welcome to episode 3 of the Sevian Father podcast, titled The Ethereum Curse. I'm Andrew Wilson, your author and host. This is a story podcast telling tales of a planeswalker in the Magic the Gathering multiverse. This is the third story, so if you haven't already listened to the first two stories, and you want to take the time to get to know Sevian and Gathy, go back and find those episodes. Otherwise, this story is a separate episode, so you should be able to pick it up and follow along. As for other news, I mentioned last episode my Johnny-centric combo article series on GatheringMagic.com, but if you're looking for more fiction, I especially recommend my article from December 5th titled Four Forms of the Dragon, in which I have four deck lists built around Form of the Dragon, one for each red-based Ravnica guild. But the relevant part here is that I also created a character and a backstory for each deck, so they're not super long, but I'm especially proud of the Izzet one, so if you want to hear about Garrosh the Fire Breather of the Cult of Rakdos, Scythus Bloodscale of the Gruul Clans, Rannis Moore of the Boros Legion, and Del Melavi of the Izzet League, check that one out. And finally, I tried a bit of an experiment this episode. Stay tuned at the end for outtakes from my recording of the story, and let me know in the show's comments how the story's going, whether the outtakes were amusing, and whatever else. As always, you can read the text versions of the stories as they're posted at sevianfather.blogspot.com. You can email me at fissionessence@hotmail.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at silent7, that's silent, then the number 7, and then the word 7, the 7 in the middle is silent. You'll hear from me again next story-sode, but without further ado, on to the show! Sevian Father, Episode 3, The Ethereum Curse.
Anstrom swung his two-sided glaive, cleaving one of the zombies in front of him, then thrust its other end backward and down into the zombie's head before it could reach up, despite its now lack of a bottom half, and claw at him. Two more of the unliving beasts shambled forward. One had two rotting arms held forward and a desiccated, sunken, ghoulish face, and it was dressed in ornate but tattered black-and-white clothes, but its entire waist area was replaced by a sinewy metal lattice that appeared to hold up the rest of its body. Inside the constructed stomach was hollow, and a gray-purple light glowed from within. The other zombie wore a similar style of clothes, but as an elaborate dress rather than pants and shirt. Its face was similarly desiccated, and dwindling strands of white blonde hair were all that remained on its head. Where the other zombie's torso was made of twisted metal, this one had the same stuff for arms, complete with the gray-purple glow. "Glalis?" Anstrom stammered. The girl zombie lurched metal claws forward, and Anstrom deftly strafed, though the claw tips tore at his garb. He grabbed an offending arm and pulled sharply as though he expected it to break away, but instead the metal of it held firm and the walking corpse stumbled and collapsed. His cheek was wet and his arms trembled, but Anstrom lifted his glaive and plunged it into the zombie girl's back. It wriggled and reached around with its glowing arms, trying to pull the weapon from its back as though the blade that skewered it were but a minor annoyance. Anstrom grimaced and held the corpse down with one of his clean black boots, and he pulled with his right arm, slicing the body from where it had been pierced all the way through its head, spilling gray rot on the white-tiled courtyard. Bits of it spattered across the ground as he roared and lifted the blade from the zombie girl's bisected skull and swung his glaive, slicing through the air before making contact with the third zombie at its neck and severing its head. He turned around and walked forward, sniffing and wiping his face with his long sleeve hanging his head. His skin was unusually pale, and his hair was finely cropped in stark black, but he wore fair white and blue clothes woven with sinews of the same metal as were infused in the zombies' bodies. It formed his shoulder pads, belt, and collar. Even his two-sided glaive seemed to be ornately crafted of nothing but the fine metal. "Who was she?" Gathy asked. Anstrom looked up. His eyes were glassy. "Glalis? She was another Telemann. We perform together sometimes." He shook his head solemnly, then looked back up at Gathy. "I hardly knew her," he laughed. Even his tears dried on his cheek, and he sniffed and wiped his nose with his sleeve again. "I'm sorry," Gathy said, and she put one hand on his shoulder, but it was the cold metal she'd learned was called ethereum, and she recoiled and moved her hand to his arm. She could feel his strong bicep underneath his sleeve, and she took a step forward into a hug. His arms wrapped back around her, and Gathy smiled, but she could feel his wet cheek pressing against her hair, and she couldn't help but feel guilty for not caring about all these people. All these people Anstrom had known, like Glalis, whom he now had to slay. It's not that she didn't care, but how could she, really? She wasn't even from this place. Esper, was it? "Ahem," Sevian coughed. Gathy backed away. "Ah, right, sorry." She could feel herself blushing and hoped Anstrom didn't notice. Sevian nodded. "Let's keep moving, shall we?" Sevian had never been to Esper, but from his sources it sounded like a place he could appreciate. His sources also indicated the plane was part of a group of neighboring planes called Alara, and that they might one day converge. Upon traveling to Esper, he discovered that his sources were correct, though a bit outdated, and that the worlds had indeed converged. But Esper appeared just as his research had described to him, and he had plenty to learn on the plane. Determining a place for the Quintess to manifest was a trifle of a task, as the whole place was rife with blue mana, and so Sevian was happy to appear in the midst of a city rather than the woods he'd been finding himself in recently. Sevian wasn't much of an artist, nor did he have much patience for the craft, but Gathy required diversion, and he couldn't afford to lose track of her again. And while they spent most of their couple days with Sevian dragging Gathy to Ethersworn Visitariums to learn more about the magical and mysterious metal that was Aetherium, on the third night, Gathy convinced Sevian to take her to a theater. The performers were called Telemans. They relinquished control of their own bodies to mage puppeteers to manipulate them on stage, creating the most eerie and unsettling play Sevian had ever seen. When Sevian's goals necessitated mind control, he preferred a command-and-go style, wherein he would implant a command and let the subject's mind's sub-processes take care of the rest. But these Telemans were beings controlled one movement at a time, and his psychic prowess let him see the proverbial strings. It was almost nauseating to see a person being subjugated so barefacedly. But the rest of the audience appeared quite pleased with the performance, most notably Gathy, who was enraptured by the hero character of the play, a young and handsome man with black hair, white skin, and a square jaw. His face was blank of emotion as he spoke his lines, though he spoke them in a deep and commanding voice, and Sevian couldn't help but respect Gathy's interest. The hero character had traversed a labyrinth in a sea of glass and defeated its guardians, and he was now entreating a sphinx, the labyrinth's creator, to bestow on him its wisdom. The Telemann who was the Sphinx wore a massive mask that covered the whole front of her torso, and the mask's mouth moved as the Sphinx spoke. Sevian sensed the simple illusion magic, but he couldn't help but be impressed by the puppeteer's ability to control multiple bodies at the same time as an illusion spell, no matter how unsettled it made him feel. It was like one musician playing all the instruments of an orchestra. "I have endured the perils of your puzzle and discovered the secrets of your halls," the hero said to the Sphinx. "Now, Kemuel, what..." The Telemann looked around the audience, confused, his face turning pink. What? He looked up to the bleachers and took a step back. The Sphinx's mask dropped to the stage floor, leaving a befuddled girl, giving the same empty look to the audience. The Telemann's puppet strings had vanished. Murmurs came across the audience, and the hero scratched his head. Kemuel, what, wisdom will you keep, or share with me? The hero shuffled his feet and stumbled through his line, unprepared to attempt the role without the puppeteer's control over his voice and body. The Sphinx girl leaned over to pick up the massive mask as though she might hold it up and resume her role, but she gave a skittish look to the hero and then to the audience, and she took the mask and ran backstage. The audience's murmurs grew louder, some of them standing up and looking at the balcony in the back of the room. "What's going on?" Gathy asked, glancing back and forth between Sevian and the handsome hero. "The mage controlling the actors has stopped the performance." "Why's that?" "I imagine we'll find out soon," he answered, and he stood up to look at the balcony along with the other patrons. Sevian could barely make out the form of someone collapsed on the floor of the balcony, but the figure grabbed at the railing and pulled itself forward, then peered its face through the bars and let out a hissing growl. While he had been alive only moments before, his face had already begun rotting, and clumps of his hair were missing. It pulled itself up to its feet, revealing an Esperite who had an entire torso and arms of Aetherium. He wore a robe-like skirt from the waist down and a matching cape with Aetherium-infused shoulder pieces. Sevian knew from his bit of research and his short stint on the plane so far that the more Aetherium an individual had, the richer and more important he was. Apparently, mage puppeteering was good business. But where the other people Sevian had seen who had Aetherium appendages had those parts glowing either white-blue or not at all, the puppeteer was glowing gray-purple.
"Avison's bloody wing, Sevian,"
Gathy cursed.
"What do we do?"
The crowd had already begun to scatter, and Sevian kept up a small force field around him to prevent any accidental contact. The puppeteer zombie put one foot over the edge of the railing, then the other, and he leapt into a crowd of finely dressed humans trying to crowd their way out of the building. He tore into them immediately, his teeth easily pulling away a chunk of flesh, and his Aetherium fingertips throwing trails of blood. Gathy screamed, though the sound was drowned by the cacophony, which included several other screams, much more blood-curdling and enduring than hers. Sevian rolled his head and shoulders back as he began to gather mana for the spell to detain the zombie, but the play's hero sprinted down the aisle, a double-ended Aetherium glaive held above his head in both hands. He cut into the puppeteer like Gathy on a bad night in Innistrad, and though the zombie's body was primarily Aetherium and deflected the blade, the puppeteer was knocked down, and the Telemann spun his blade once over his head, then lowered it, and swiftly severed the creature at its neck. The theater was mostly cleared, but the people who had fallen under the puppeteer's initial attack were now standing back up. They all had one limb or another replaced with Aetherium, as was quite common on Esper, especially at such a high-end venue. But as with the puppeteer, their augmentations now glowed gray-purple, and their flesh had already become rotten. I thought, the hero Telamon yelled as he sliced one from shoulder to hip, I left you, he sliced a second with another deft cut of his blade, in Grixis! And he cut down the third and then the fourth and final zombie with two more swings.
Well, hello there, Gathi said, having snuck down the aisle as Sevian had watched the battle.
Fine work with the Wrathcrawlers there, she smiled.
What?
The Telamon turned, startled, his glaive in both hands and ready to strike again. Gathi backed a bit from him and put her hands up for a moment.
The zombies, she said, and gestured to the scattered remnants of metal and flesh.
I'm Gathi. She held her hand out to shake his. He lowered his eyebrows, but he let go of his weapon with one hand and shook hers. Anstrom. Sevian nodded. Let's keep moving, shall we? After their incident in the theater, Sevian, Gathi, and Anstrom had traveled together around the city of Kingport. Anstrom had cited several places he wanted to search for survivors, but everywhere they looked there were only corpses, and almost all of them were walking. However, some were simply dead, bodies of homeless and other lower-class citizens they found in alleyways apparently torn apart by the well-dressed, purple-glowing zombies. And for their part, the zombies seemed to be mostly unaware of their surroundings, only occasionally taking notice of the living passers-by, but when they did, Anstrom had quite a proficiency for punishing them. After Anstrom had disposed of his former friend Glalas and the two other zombies, Sevian took the lead again. His psychic net revealed small pockets of survivors, but without the Quintess, he couldn't know if they were victims or perpetrators of whatever affliction was now spreading across Kingport, and rather than tell Gathi and Anstrom of the survivors, whom they might then want to waste time trying to save, Sevian began leading them to the Quintess so he could use its power to try to search out some source of the corruption. The zombie killing left both Gathi and Anstrom in a somber mood, which left them quiet and gave Sevian more time to think. But Sevian turned and glanced at them, seeing Gathi leaning into Anstrom, holding his arm as they walked together behind him. Sevian rolled his eyes and took a deep breath. It could be difficult convincing Gathi to continue traveling with him if she was so attached. He shook his head, one problem at a time. But eventually, Gathi broke the silence.
Anstrom, she muttered.
They'd been taking wide, sinewy paths through open streets, avoiding wandering zombies, and taking awkward roundabouts to sidestep narrow halls that contained shambling undead. She had to clear her throat after the silence while also speaking silently to avoid catching the attention of a potential aggressor.
Do you know these Wrathcrawlers?
He looked down at her, and she let go of his arm and looked to the ground.
You said something about life in them in Grixis.
In Grixis, he answered. Yeah, it's where I'm from.
I'm from Innistrad, Gathi said. We have zombies, too, and vampires.
Is that in Jund? Sounds like home, Anstrom grumbled. Sevian recognized the names Grixis and Jund. They were two of the other plain fragments of Alara that had apparently now converged. His research had led him to Esper, though, and he hadn't done much studying of the others. He'd heard the boy mention Grixis earlier, but he hadn't considered the ramifications. He only knew it was a dark place that lacked green and white magic. It would make sense for such a place to be filled with zombies, so if Anstrom was from there, it would explain his familiarity with the undead and his skill in dispatching them.
Nay, rint in Jund, Gathi's voice tapered out.
Sevian had never warned her not to divulge their interplanar origins, and he wondered if she felt awkward discussing it now. Even he had only met a few other people capable of such travel, and other than those few, Sevian had met almost no one who were distinctly aware that other worlds existed.
Is Graxis in Esper?
Sevian said we're in Esper.
It's not, Anstrom answered. I mean, we are. We are in Esper, but Grixis isn't.
Sevian kept walking and didn't turn to look at the two as they conversed, but the boys sounded quite confused, and the old scientist couldn't help but be amused. There was a moment of silence in their own footsteps as the three walked down the hallway. They'd entered the apartment building where Sevian had parked the Quintess. Gathi jogged up next to Sevian and almost put her hand on his shoulder to get his attention, but he shifted to his left and turned to her as she walked.
Yes?
Gathi dropped her hands.
What's he mean? Does he move between worlds as well?
No, Sevian said. Here there were five worlds that collapsed into one, but we can go anywhere we want. Sevian opened the door to the Quintess, walked inside, and shut the door behind him, leaving Gathi and her crush outside. He would deal with Anstrom later, but for now he would rather avoid having to explain his room to someone else, and he could use the quiet for his psychic search. Anstrom stopped walking and cocked his neck slightly back. He looked up and down the hallway. It looked like an average Esper apartment building for middle-class citizens like him, and the building where he lived was much like this one. Doors lined both sides of the wall evenly up and down the passage, but the door the old man had just entered was the same style of door as the others, but it was right in the middle of two of the evenly spaced doors.
Anstrom wondered why anyone would build three apartments in the same space that should have contained two. So, the red-haired girl started, I guess we are supposed to wait here. What does he have to do in the apartment?
That's not an apartment, room, or whatever. That's the Quintus.
Quintus?
That's how we travel.
The girl seemed quite proud of her explanation, but it didn't make any sense.
I see. So, what's to do while we wait for him?
Kathy was smiling widely, and she put her fingers on his chest and traced down the center of his torso. Anstrom took her by the shoulders and stepped back. I don't know. The sounds of clawing on one of the nearby doors started, and Anstrom realized that the rooms could be full of zombies. Grix's zombies were bloodthirsty and tenacious, but so far the ones they'd encountered had mostly been passive, only mildly interested in attacking them when they were already close by.
Sorry, I know it must be tough on ya,
Kathy said, apparently noticing the scratching as well.
I seen zombies back home, but never so many of them, and the Cathars always came to bless their life out of them.
In Grixis, we lived with them. They were everywhere. The doors on one side of the hall were evenly staggered against the doors on the opposite side, which meant Sevian's extra door was directly across from a normal one, and that was the one with the apparent zombie on the other side. Anstrom fell back, leaning his back against it, and slid down to sit. If the zombie began breaking it down instead of idly clawing, he'd be ready. My mother is a necromancer. Some humans are struggling to survive there still, though many have escaped to the other shards by now or died trying. Kathy sat and crossed her legs, leaning against Sevian's door. Anstrom had never seen someone with such green eyes or such red hair. He'd heard stories of some of the feral and colorful creatures of Naya, and he wondered if Kathy was from there. She seemed nice, though her friend was off-putting. Sevian acted like an old man, and his white hair and beard seemed to make it clear, except he was fit and vigorous, and there were no wrinkles around his eyes or on his forehead. And when he looked in his eyes, it was like there was nothing.
"How'd you get here, then?"
Kathy asked. "I mean, from one wheel to the next?" "It's like you're not from a shard at all," Anstrom answered. "How do you not know about the conflux?"
"I'm from Innistrad, I told you. The Quintus," she pointed with her thumb to the door behind her, "takes us anywhere Sirians is. We went to Eras and then here."
Anstrom shook his head.
"It's like a bunch of different worlds, I guess."
He sat quietly for a moment, listening solemnly to the clawing at the door, and the girl poked one at a time some of the many freckles on her arm, glancing back up at him every few seconds. She seemed to struggle to find something to say, and then asked,
"What's the conflux?"
"Oh," he said, "it's like, I don't know. In Grixis, there was an impassable field of bane wasps, but one day it was all washed up into the shores of a sea that was never there before. They say it was the conflux, when the shards merged."
"The shards?"
"Yes, Grixis, Esper, Jund, Naya, and Bant. My mother, she would find anything living and suck the life from them to add to her army. She wanted me and my brother to be like her. Generals in her army, I suppose. So when the sea appeared, we crossed it. On this side, the Esperites called the sea Kingdom of Fog."
"You had a brother?"
Kathy sat up straight and widened her eyes.
"Why didn't you say? Where is he?"
"He joined the Ethersworn shortly after we arrived, and I became a Telemann. Easy work, good pay. We haven't spoken much since. I don't know." Anstrom took a deep breath. "I don't know. Sevian said he couldn't sense anyone living." Kathy slumped down and looked to the floor, and she almost fell backward when the door swung open behind her. "We're ready," Sevian said, smiling. Sevian said he'd sent someone underground, and Anstrom said that meant they would need to search the Tide Hollow. The three of them left the apartment building, leaving the zombies scratching at the insides of their doors, and weaved through the streets, mostly avoiding further encounters, with Anstrom only bloodying his glaive a few times along the way.
"Why don't we just take the Quintus?"
Kathy asked Sevian. If it could travel between worlds, and what did that mean anyway? How far away was one world from another? Why couldn't the Quintus just jump a few thousand feet?
"It doesn't work that way," he replied. "I can guide it between planes, and the engine pinpoints a suitable spot for manifestation, but more precise landings would require a much higher level of familiarity with the destination."
Kathy looked to Anstrom as they walked, and he seemed just as lost in the vagueness, so she smiled at him, but he quickly looked away, and she let her face turn blank again and faced the ground as she walked. Anstrom led them to the edge of the city and down to sea level, where the shore met the Kingdom of Fog. Kathy had seen pools, she had seen streams, and she had seen the lake on Eris. She had heard of the tumultuous seas of Nephalia, but the Kingdom of Fog was different. The water was placid, and for a moment it looked like a massive mirror that spread out to the horizon. But the only thing that was there to reflect was a fog that spread immeasurably into the distance. The fog was dense enough that she could see nothing but it in the flat waters, but it was thin enough that Kathy might have sworn she could see it all, even as it continued into infinity. Kathy wondered who would live in such a kingdom. "This is where you came from?" she asked.
"That's right," Anstrom answered, staring out at the watery kingdom. "My brother and I rowed a small, bone-carved boat. When we left the Grixis wind behind and we were too tired to row, I thought we would die out there, in the middle of nowhere. And it would have been better than spending another day in Grixis. But the boat just kept moving. It was a miracle."
Gathy tentatively put one hand on his shoulder, afraid he would back away from her again. But he stood still, placid as the sea, as he stared out at it. She put her other hand on his arm and stood up against him.
"Don't worry, Anstrom. We'll solve all this and find your brother." "Right, Sivian?"
The strange man nodded. "Come on." Anstrom broke his position and moved away from Gathy without looking at her, and he followed Sivian down the glassy beach. Gathy shook a chill away and followed.
"Up ahead is a cave entrance," Anstrom said. He walked into the water and pointed ahead to where a natural stone marked the edge of the glassy sand. "The water flows in there and continues all through the tide hollow. There are caves that extend throughout the underground of Esper, but they're flooded. Near the entrance, there's a dry patch where we'll have parties sometimes, but past that is all waterways. We'll have to wait for a sculler to lead us through the tide caves."
The three travelers waded through the water and into the cave mouth. Gathy was the third through the opening, and whereas she realized she might have expected the cave to be dark, lit only by the waning light of the evening Esper sky and clouded further by the fog, the cave was instead lit by a flickering lantern that hung from the tip of a boat that was shaped like a waning crescent moon. The light danced off the walls of the cave that were ribbed by sinewy rock, like protruding veins, and on the boat stood a robed figure, its purple hood up, with only darkness and smoke for a face. Long clawed, spindly fingers clutched a paddle, seemingly ready to row. The figure stood, staring forward at the three, unmoving. Sivian and Anstrom were standing still, facing it.
"It's a sculler," Anstrom said.
"You said we'd have to wait for one," Sivian answered.
"I don't know. I've never seen a sculler. They say never to pay one, but that they're the only ones that can find their way through the tide caves. I guess he knew we were coming."
Gathy moved forward between the men, and they moved apart for her. To the left, the ground was higher, and she pulled herself from the waist-high water up onto the dry ground. The sculler's boat was up against the dry ledge, and she kept moving forward to the smoke-faced figure.
"Wait, Gathy," Sivian said. She heard him and Anstrom climbing out of the water behind her, but the sculler didn't even seem frightening. It looked creepy, but everything had been generally less horrific since she'd left Innistrad, and the creature wasn't even moving as she continued toward it.
Clearly it knew they were coming. Why else would it just be waiting there? Anstrom said scullers were how people navigated Tide Hollow, so why not just move up and climb aboard the ferry? But when she was only a few feet away, she froze. Her arms and legs couldn't move, and her breath rushed out of her body. The sculler stood still, unmoving as it stared down at her. She looked right up its hood from just a few feet away, and it was as though the infinite of the fog from the sea outside was all that was within the purple hood.
"I said to wait. I can't have you killed."
Sivian came up behind her, and the hold in her body broke. She collapsed to the muddy stone floor, and she could breathe again.
"That was you? I couldn't breathe, you rot-brained fool."
Sivian started to answer, but the sculler's movement caught all their attention. It let go of its oar with one hand and reached into one of the folds of its robe, producing a handful of marbles. Gathy had previously only seen them in the hands of rich Thraben children, and she certainly didn't expect to find them here. Two yellow marbles of different shades rode from the sculler's hand and circled through each other through the air. A gray marble rose and floated in between their circling, and then shot forward and backward. Smoke from the sculler's face wafted forward into the display, and wisps of the smoke flew in all directions, pushed by the volition of the flying marbles.
"It can take us anywhere we want to go," Anstrom said, "but we have to pay."
"The marbles mean something, dear. You said not to pay it." The marbles fell and clattered back into the pile in the sculler's hand. Another batch of smoke blew out from its hood and was thrown around by four more marbles that rose and danced before her. She might have tried to remember the pattern, but she was distracted by the memories. In a blue marble, she saw the color of the sky on the first day, the first time her father gave her new boots to go hunting with him. In a dark green marble, she saw the color of the vendor's eyes from whom she once bought a bag of potatoes. The vendor was a renowned haggler, but he was kind to her. In a light green marble, Gathy saw the bush that was in front of her face after she woke up from a blackout that she now recognized was her first werewolf transformation. Her clothes had all been in tatters. And in a white marble, she saw the silver buckles of the new boots Sivian had given her after he'd rescued her from Innistrad only a week before.
"He wants my boots as payment," Gathy said.
"Interesting," Sivian said. "The marbles mean something."
"They're like memories," Anstrom answered. "They just all make sense together."
"Not much for talking, are you?" Sivian asked the sculler, but it simply stared back, its face bellowing smoke and marbles clattering as they shuffled around in its fist. Four more marbles rose and spun around. Gathy saw nothing in them, but Sivian and Anstrom seemed both entranced. She knelt and began unbuckling her boots.
"There's still nothing in there," Sivian said, sounding irritated.
Kathy smiled silently. It wasn't often he couldn't figure something out. How do they work?
My pendant, Anstrom said. He lifted his hidden silver chain from around his neck, and with it came a dagger-shaped pendant, though it looked sharp enough to Gathy that it could serve as a pendant-shaped dagger, come the worst. An onyx orb served as a hilt, and a metal snake-like spiral circled the orb, holding it in place and connecting the dagger to the chain.
It's my payment.
Anstrom moved forward and held out his pendant, but the sculler pointed a long, crooked finger into a hidden crevice of the boat. Anstrom nodded and tossed the pendant in, and Gathy heard it land with a plink. The sculler stepped aside, making room for Anstrom to climb aboard, and the attractive boy from Grixis did so, looking out to Gathy and nodding with a small smile. Gathy smiled back widely and moved toward the boat. She could see the pile where the pendant had landed. It was all knick-knacks, from coins to clothes to toy sphinx. She tossed her boots on the pile and climbed aboard with her bare feet. Sevian stood in the dry patch still, a befuddled look on his face. The sculler opened the marbled hand again, and three floated up from the rest. A black marble floated idly, while a light blue one orbited it, and a green marble flew wildly around, occasionally clanging into the blue one and bouncing off without disrupting the orbit. Then the blue and green marbles settled next to the black one, rolling around it in tight circles, and one by one the three landed back into the pile in the sculler's hand, and the creature stowed them all back in its robe.
"I see," Sevian said. "Go ahead, then."
Smoke coalesced in front of the sculler's hood and floated like a cold dragon's breath toward Sevian. It clouded his head and then dissipated. Sevian smiled and nodded, then moved forward to climb into the boat, but the sculler made a sudden lurch forward and hissed. Gathy fell back into Anstrom, whose hand was already on his glaive. One of the folds of the sculler's robe spread its wings and flew forward, flapping and hovering in the space between Sevian and the tide-hollow creature. It was some kind of large bird with a curved beak and razor talons, and its wings were laced with ethereum, the same way most of Esper's peoples seemed to be. Sevian backed away. "Fine, fine, you can have it." He looked to Gathy. "It wants a stupid old memory. I tried to trick it, but I'm going to lower my psychic defenses now. Remember the Pharos's wall."
"What?"
Gathy asked, but Sevian nodded to the sculler and the smoke returned. When it dissipated this time, it did so into the sculler's hand, coalescing into a red marble. The hooded figure stowed the marble in its robe, and Gathy heard it click against the others. The bird landed on the sculler's shoulder and folded its wings into the robes, and Gathy couldn't tell it was there despite having just seen it land. Sevian moved forward and boarded into the back of the boat, opposite Gathy and Anstrom. She was somewhat pleased to have the front of the boat with the black-haired boy, though it was a small boat, and she still had to stand unpleasantly close to the sculler.
"Sevian," Gathy asked, as the sculler pushed them away from the small plateau, "what's the Pharos's wall?"
Sevian shook his head.
"I don't know what you mean."
He turned and put his hand on the side of the boat, looking out into the distance. Gathy turned to Anstrom, moving in closer to him and smiling, and she whispered,
"Skold, you know."
"I'm used to it," he answered. And with one strong row from the sculler, the boat drifted swiftly into the tide hollow. The caves of the tide hollow were sinewy and treacherous, the tides of the underground streams seeming to want to carry them opposite directions all at once. But with just one casual row of his oar every couple minutes, the tide hollow sculler easily kept them moving along some path known only to him. Sevian had described to the sculler the relative position of the place he had seen in his psychic search. In the Quintus, the psychic mage had been able to determine the presence and general location of some sentient entity underground, and he could sense that the place was also the source of the corrupting magic. So he knew where to go, but the sculler was the one who knew how to get there. Somehow, with only Sevian's limited description of their destination, the sculler had released a puff of smoke in consent and begun the rowing, apparently understanding exactly where to go. The air was cold in the tide hollow, and Sevian was beginning to regret the frequent traveling between planes. Above ground, Esper had been quite tepid. The weather mages were obviously proficient. But thrusted back into the cold and being occasionally splashed by icy water, Sevian was irritated by the constant switching of temperature from the cold of Innistrad to the heat of the primordial Eris to the wet chill of the tide hollow. At the front of the boat, Gathy and Anstrom were sitting together, bundled up with her head in his chest. Sevian exhaled a grunt, and he could see the cloud of his breath for a moment as the light of the sculler's swinging lantern flickered across it. At the beginning of the boat ride, Anstrom had let her stand alone, and he seemed to be ignoring her interest. But the ride continued, twisting and turning through the countless chambers, and 45 minutes later, Anstrom had succumbed to the cold and to Gathy, letting her sit next to him and rubbing her back. Wasn't she from Innistrad? Sevian wondered why there couldn't just be one straight passage that could lead them to their destination. His psychic pinpointing hadn't made it seem this far inland. It wasn't too much longer before the sculler pulled them up to the water's edge, and the boat stopped abruptly but without bumping the shoreline. Sevian nodded in respect for whatever boatman magic was at work.
The chamber they were in was large and would have been completely dark were it not for the Sculler's lantern. Even with the light, Sevian couldn't tell whether the ceiling was black or just too high for the light to reach. The small bit of high ground that was in the chamber was right along the edge of the wall and right next to them, and it led into a crevice ahead that would take them out of the chamber, which appeared to otherwise be covered in water. The Sculler simply stopped the boat and then took the oar in both hands and stood idly. "Finally," Sevian said, and he telekinetically and invisibly lifted himself out of the boat, though he created an illusionary simulacrum of himself that moved its arms and legs as though it were climbing out, and Sevian set himself down an inch above the muddy tide cave floor.
"Let's go, then. This is it."
Gathy stood and stepped out of the boat, taking one of Anstrom's hands as she did so. Sevian shook his head. He would have to do something about them if he was going to be able to leave Anstrom behind and take Gathy on to continue his work. But Anstrom let his arm hang loosely as Gathy held it, and when she was clear of the boat, he took his hand back, still crouching inside. Anstrom glanced back and forth between the Sculler and the interplanar pair, then grabbed something from the Sculler's pile of knick-knacks and leapt from the skiff. Sevian stepped back from the sudden commotion and gathered mana for the impending battle between Anstrom and the Sculler, not yet quite sure what side he'd be on. The Sculler snapped to face Anstrom's direction, and the folds of its robe spread a pair of wings again. The bird leaned forward and screeched. The sound echoed through the chamber and woke a colony of what sounded like metal-winged bats on the ceiling. The screech was still reverberating across the water, and the bats were scraping their wings against each other in the stalactites, but none of Anstrom, the Sculler, nor his bird moved any further, and Sevian held his spell. Anstrom stood still with his right arm out, pointing at the Sculler with a metal chain hanging from his fist. He'd taken back his dagger pendant. "Never pay the Sculler, they say," Anstrom said. The bird squawked again, and Gathy moved up behind Anstrom and put her hands on his shoulder and back.
"You got to pay him, Anstrom."
But the Sculler put its oar in the water and pushed off, and the lantern light disappeared. Sevian quickly channeled his unused mana into an illusion spell to light the chamber again, but the Sculler and its skiff had vanished, and the bats were settling back into place above. Anstrom draped his chain around his neck, tucked the dagger into his shirt, and smiled at Gathy as he turned and started down the passage. "We're on our own from here," Sevian said. Kathy's heart was pounding. Sure, there was the scare with the Sculler, but more importantly, Anstrom had let her sit next to him. Despite the cold, which wasn't nearly as bad as the cold night in the Ulvenwald anyway, her hand was still warm from where she had held his, and he had smiled at her as he walked away from the Sculler. Without her boots, though, her feet were already sore. The ground was mucky and chilled, which wouldn't have been so bad but for the occasional icy stone that dug into her feet as she stepped. Sevian led the way with his spell lighting the path ahead of them. Apparently he had some idea of where they should be going, not that there had been any turns to make so far. Gathy had won her fair share of scraps and done her fair share of hunting, and Sevian had rescued her from Innistrad's moon and figured a way for them out of the laboratory in Eras, but somehow she felt safer with Anstrom around. "So," Sevian said, turning his head back toward Gathy and Anstrom as he spoke, though his voice echoed quite loudly in the tight corridor anyway, "the zombies we encountered in Kingport were all infused with Ethereum, and of those we found killed by the zombies, none had any of the metal in them. Quite lucky, then, that we all lack Ethereum enhancement." Gathy nodded silently. The idea of replacing one's own body parts with magic and metal was repulsive, and part of her felt a little vindicated that, at least in Esper, the blessed sleep was only interrupted for those who brought it upon themselves. "Actually," Anstrom said, "my elbow." Gathy and Sevian both turned to him as they walked. "It was one of the first things I did once I could afford it," he continued. He pulled up his right sleeve, showing where everything from his elbow and halfway down his forearm had been replaced with the metal, glowing a soft white. Gathy was speechless, and Sevian just faced ahead again, continuing solemnly on. "My mother spent her life taking flesh from others so she could keep hers, and she wanted my brother and me to do the same. When I saw the Esperites and their Therium, I found a way to make sure my body and my life couldn't be taken from me." He dropped his sleeve back down and looked to Gathy, but she left him in the corner of her eye and walked quietly until another stone made her curse. "Well then," Sevian said, "I guess that doesn't explain why you weren't affected by the necromancy." And then he stopped and turned to face Anstrom and Gathy, crossing his arms. He glared an accusation at the handsome boy, and Anstrom's mouth opened, but nothing came out. Gathy thought back about their day. Was Sevian right? Had every zombie had purple glowing Ethereum, and was every victim's corpse they'd seen free of it? She couldn't think of anyone who broke that pattern except now Anstrom. If he had Ethereum, why was it still not affected, and why hadn't his flesh rotted away? Had she fallen for the wrong guy, and was he leading them into a trap? But no, Sevian had led them there. Sevian and the Sculler. "It's not my doing, I swear," Anstrom finally stammered, but Sevian wasn't looking at him anymore. With his arms still crossed, he was glancing around at parts of the stone walls as though a wasp were circling his head, and he struggled to catch sight of it. "What's there?" Kathy asked, looking for something in the air but seeing nothing. There's something wrong here. It's familiar, but I can't remember why. Sevian put his hands on the cave wall and felt around as though he were looking for a hidden latch that would open some secret door. Anstrom took to feeling up and down the opposite wall. Maybe it's over here. He groped uselessly across the stone surface. Kathy rolled her eyes and turned back to Sevian. A secret door? Had one back at my parents' what led to underground escape routes in case of vampires or graphicors? I don't know, Sevian snapped. I should remember. He was pounding his flat hand against the stone, and Kathy watched the two men as they felt at the opposite sides of the tide cave hall. But as she watched, something Sevian had said clicked. A fieros wall. He whipped his head back toward her. A what? A fieros wall. Is it to remember it? Yes, the Pharos's wall. This is just like that. He flicked his wrist, this time spinning a spiral of blue light from his hand, which twisted and then disappeared, taking several feet of wall with it like a whirlpool going down a drain. Behind it was another dark cave corridor, naturally formed but somehow blocked off by the now-gone wall. Anstrom took his hands from the stone and turned toward Kathy, Sevian, and the new passage, staring blank-facedly as they proceeded. "What's all that about?" Kathy asked. "What's a Pharos?" Long ago, I worked with a Vedelkin who had a secret wall. One day, I discovered it and entered his secret lab where he had been exploring a very dangerous project. Magic of such secret walls is quite commonplace, actually, but the Sculler wanted my memory of the Vedelkin's lab, presumably so we could not find our way through here. I blocked the Sculler's access to my memory, but he wouldn't let me board, so I made a backup of the memory and let him take the original. The backup would have naturally resurfaced in time, but it's good you assisted me, or it could have taken endless wandering before we found our way. The white-haired man looked back to the two younger explorers. According to my psychic reconnoiter, the spell responsible for the undead in Kingport emanated from ahead. We must stay quiet as we approach. Kathy's sore feet crunched on the mucky, bumpy floor, and she could hear Anstrom's crunching footsteps as well, while Sevian still silently walked an inch above the ground. Kathy narrowed her eyes and shook her head. What was his problem with touching? The corridor took a sharp turn, and around the corner the three found themselves facing only a short passage further before another long, open chamber. Sevian quickly released his light spell and put his finger to his lips, but the cavern was well lit by a series of crude torches. Like most of the Tide Hollow, the chamber was mostly flooded, but on the opposite side of the wall was more dry land, which was where the torches hung and where a very uncharacteristic staircase led up about 20 feet to a small ledge and a metal door in the rock ceiling. Small crumbling obelisks decorated the dry ground on the other side, though the ones closer to the water were much more stubby and eroded, and Kathy wondered how long they could have lasted with the cave's tides. A hunk of rock that might have once been finely crafted altar was in the center of the ground, and the obelisks, altar, and stairs all had small indentations that might have once been runic carvings. But contrasting the old gray stone structures were fresh white bones littering the ground and scattered atop the altar, and hovering even above the bones was an ethereum orb swirling and spitting a cloud of mist the same gray-purple as the zombie's glow. "That's it," Anstrom called, and he rushed forward, wading into the water and throwing one arm after the other over his head as he began swimming across. "Wait!" Sevian yelled, rubbing his forehead, but Anstrom was half-submerged. "We don't want to make noise. Someone is on the other side of that door." Kathy nodded. "Do you really think he's part of all this?" Sevian paused and narrowed his lips. "He's a very suspicious boy. Come on." Sevian lifted his arm, and Kathy felt it pull her up, though it didn't touch her. She always imagined birds flew freely with nothing to hold them back, but when Sevian lifted her, it was like she was in the grip of some invisible force, with its fingerless hands all over her. She wriggled and tried to get out of the grasp, but seconds later, Sevian had set her down on the opposite side, next to Anstrom, as he pulled himself out of the water. He shook his head like a hound after a rainstorm, took his glaive from his back, and removed his drenched coat, leaving nothing but his dagger pendant, toned muscles, and an ethereum elbow. "Oh," Anstrom muttered, "you're dry." "It's okay," Kathy smiled. She put her hand half on his chest and half on his ribs. "We're all across now, eh?" "Yeah," he said. He smiled and put his hand on her shoulder, then moved forward to the altar and the floating ethereum orb. "Stop," Sevian said. "We don't know what effect it could have to the touch, especially since you have ethereum in you." Sevian stepped toward it and leaned in. "Let me examine it, and then perhaps I can counteract the spell in the orb." "And then Kingport will be fine?" Sevian looked to Anstrom and stood up straight. "Those people are dead, Anstrom. Counteracting the spell should keep the curse from spreading farther into Esper." Anstrom's shoulders slumped, and Kathy stepped back. "Ouch!" The shout rang out through the chamber. She'd stepped directly on one of the stray bones, one that Kathy now assumed had been used by its original owner to tear chunks of meat away from its victims, just as it had now done to her. Bootless, thanks to the Sculler, she crouched and clutched her gashed underfoot. "Stay quiet," Sevian said, glancing up at the door and the top of the stairs, "and be careful." and he closed his eyes and a few splew magic around the gray-purple filigree orb. Anstrom knelt down next to her. Are you all right?
I just cut myself on this bone.
She dipped her foot in the water and rinsed away the blood.
Floor here's right dirty, too.
Anstrom's thin black hair was still dripping as he leaned over her and took her foot in his hands, rubbing his thumb over the gash as it leaked blood. It's not too deep, he smiled, inches from her reddening face. You'll be fine.
She sputtered. I suppose I will.
Suddenly the surface of the water rose, pregnant with some massive force, and then broke, surging tide and spraying precipitation across the chamber. The creature that burst from the water was dripping with both moisture and its own flesh. Two carriages would have struggled to carry the beast, and its massive jaws, only partially connected with meat or sinews, could have bitten a werewolf in half. What was left of its skin looked like tanned leather, but otherwise it resembled a massive predatory fish, fins and all. "Cataract shark!" Anstrom called out. A massive front section had emerged from the water, and Gaffey briefly tried to fathom how much of the creature was still hidden. The front of it fell down, jaws open, directly toward Gaffey. She staggered back out of the water on her injured foot and held her hands uselessly above her head. But Anstrom was between Gaffey and the shark a moment later, his glaive in both hands. He thrust one end up into the creature's maw, jabbing it through the top of its head. Anstrom twisted, throwing the beast with his glaive as a handle. Unfazed, the zombie shark bit down, taking Anstrom with it as it fell back into the dark water.
No!
Gaffey yelled, falling forward in a lunging attempt to grab Anstrom. He should be okay for now, Sevian said from across the room. His arm was outstretched and tense. I think I was able to block most of its bite.
Well, help him then. He's down there with the thing.
Sevian nodded and took a few swift steps toward the water. He knelt and waved his hand over the cave pool, and the dark water disappeared. Suddenly, Gaffey could see down several hundred feet, and she could barely make out the pool floor through the darkness. She immediately felt queasy, as though she were on the steep edge of a deep pit, and she could still feel the invisible water lapping at her arms and knees as she peered over. Bits of darkness, perhaps dirt, floated like a fog of gnats in the invisible water, and among them was a cloud of pink drifting away from where Gaffey had rinsed her foot. And halfway between the surface and the pool floor was another cloud of pink, this one deeper in color and much larger, and inside it, swimming in unseen water, was the cataract shark. But there was no sign of the black-haired Telemann. Anstrom's glaive was stuck through the top of its head still, though, and the aquatic zombie was floundering as it swam, looking like a fish trying to find its way on land. And then the glaive moved, pulled from the inside, the edge slicing through the shark's head, neck, and back. It arched backward from the tension and flailed more. Bits of loosened flesh floated away in the invisible tide, and from the new opening swam Anstrom, bringing with him a deeper cloud of red. With one hand on his glaive, he kicked limply with both feet and pulled himself up through the water with his free arm. A ring of teeth marks almost all the way around his waist was emanating pink, and he stared up at Gaffey with his wide eyes, pursed lips, and paling cheeks. Behind him, the shark was twitching, whereas Gaffey would have much preferred to see it falling limp.
"Sevian!"
she called, slamming one fist in the clear, shallow water, and she recoiled from the invisible splash that took her in one eye. But the white-bearded stranger was already in the midst of something, as a bubble that looked like a torchlight halo appeared in front of him. It flew down into the chasm toward Anstrom as Sevian lightly gestured with his left hand. The bubble stopped around Anstrom's head as the boy pulled himself up through the invisible water and his mouth opened. Gaffey saw him breathe and realized she should as well, but her vision refocused and the shark had regained its composure, though its back was still open and more bits of the beast hung loose than before. "Up we go," Sevian said, lifting his right hand up, and with it came Anstrom, shooting through the remaining distance. Sevian lowered his hand, and Anstrom alighted softly, taking another deep breath. This time, Gaffey presumed, from the uncomfortable grasp of Sevian's telekinesis. The shark shot up as well, propelled through the clear liquid by the swiveling of its tail like an unbound, vengeful geist. But Sevian put both his hands out over the chasm, as though he were going to pull himself up onto an invisible shoulder-height ledge, and he took a deep stance and closed his eyes. When the shark hit where Gaffey imagined the water's surface still was, it came to a dead stop, and Sevian's braced arm shuddered. The cataract shark's momentum against Sevian's force field had shattered the whole front of the beast, and it drifted limply down into the dust-speckled darkness. Anstrom had retrieved his drenched coat and wrapped it around his waist. He sat leaning against the cracking stone altar and pressed on his wounds to stop the bleeding, and the empty space in his ethereum elbow had begun glowing a pale white light.
"Are you okay?"
Gaffey asked, rushing over to him and kneeling down, grimacing from the pain of her own bloodied foot. "I think I'll be fine," Anstrom laughed weakly and coughed. "It sensed your vis."
"What?"
"From your foot. It could smell the blood in the water." "That was not an Esper denizen, Anstrom," Sevian said. He had immediately resumed attending to the orb, but he stopped now and walked over to the side of the altar to look sternly down at Gaffey and Anstrom, and Gaffey suddenly felt as though she had just yelled at a priest, and as though her father were the one looking down at her in accusation. "That was a Grixis zombie."
"Yeah,
That's the type of creature that lurks in Ketterect waters. Kathy backed away slowly and stood up. There were zombies in Grixis and now in Esper, same as Anstrom's path. He was the only Ethereum-infused person not affected by the curse, and now there was an undead Grixis monstrosity in the same room as the orb that caused it all. "Anstrom," she said. "How could ye?" But the metal door at the top of the stairs flew open. Through it shambled a gray-purple glowing zombie, and then another, and then another. A crowd of them emerged, pushing each other through the passage. "I had nothing to do with it," Anstrom yelled, and he dropped his coat and picked up his glaive as he stood. Each of the tooth marks had scabbed over already, and he appeared recovered as he turned toward the oncoming horde. Kathy wanted to say, "I'm sorry," but she still wasn't sure. Even if some other Grixis necromancer had come across the Kingdom of Fog, why would Anstrom have been unaffected by the curse? Some zombies shambled down the stairs, fumbling slowly over their own footing, but others flooded out onto the ledge and fell off, only to start pulling themselves back to their rotting feet. "Well, now," a voice announced from beyond the doorway, "that's not completely true now, is it?" A boy about Gathy's age emerged at the top of the stairs. He wore standard blues and grays of Esper fashion, but no visible part of him was Ethereum, and he had the same pale complexion and black hair as Anstrom, but he was shorter and scrawnier, and there were egg-sized holes in his earlobes. He outstretched one arm, and the Ethereum orb flew across the chamber and into his hand. "Ulquart," Sevian said. Anstrom only stood still, glaring up at the boy and pointing one end of his glaive toward the zombies. "Your brother?" Kathy whispered, moving closer to Anstrom again. "So, he has talked about me," Ulquart lilted. "I have to say, I was a little offended by the 'I had nothing to do with it' stuff. I am your brother, after all." The zombies stopped their moving forward, a virtual wall of them between the three travelers and the stairs. "I thought we got ourselves away from all this, Ulquart," Anstrom said. "We left Grixis for a reason." "Well, we both had our reasons. Mother wants this place for herself, Anstrom, and we can take it for her. Look, I've already done the heavy lifting, and I excluded you from the curse and everything. Come back to the family, brother." "Shut up, you skinny fool. Anstrom's not that kind of person." Kathy looked over at Anstrom as he stolidly stood with his glaive pointed toward the undead. "Right?" she whispered. Ulquart laughed. "Who's your new girlfriend, Anstrom? I'm sure Mother would let you keep her as a pet, once she's drained most of her vis, of course." "That's not going to happen. Give the orb to Sevian and forget about all this." Anstrom shook his head and sighed. "Just go back home." "You don't understand. I didn't come to Esper to get away from Mother. She sent me here with a task, and I've completed it. Do you really think we rowed ourselves across that stupid endless ocean? I can't believe you bought those dregs about the miracle that kept us moving the whole time." Anstrom narrowed his eyes and curled his lip in confusion. "The shark," Sevian said. "Bright friend of yours," Ulquart answered. "I suppose he can come, too." "You were working with Mother the whole time? The dream of getting away from her, from Grixis? Of starting new lives? The hope of crossing the sea alive, but being willing to die out there, just to be away from her in that lifeless cape?" Anstrom's voice was rising louder than Gathy had heard him speak before. "And the whole time, we were just riding on the back of Mother's stupid sea thrall while you plotted your betrayal? Don't be so selfish. You were the one who betrayed..." But Anstrom was no longer listening, and Ulquart was cut off by the sound of Anstrom's glaive slicing through one of the zombies. The others immediately moved in around him, and he readied to strike at the next of them, but the undead were knocked back by a wave of invisible force, and Sevian stood with his arm out like he'd just skipped a stone across a pond. "I was afraid of this. I guess Mother did give you that dagger necklace for a reason," Ulquart said, and he clutched a pendant from around his own neck. Sevian's eyes widened, and from across the room he lifted the pendant from around Anstrom's neck, but it was too late, and Anstrom collapsed even as the dagger necklace floated through the air and was tossed into a corner of the muddy cave floor. "Anstrom!" Kathy yelled, and she ran over to him despite the walking corpses that were already righting themselves. Anstrom's Ethereum elbow was glowing white again, and she could feel his pulse, but when she shook him, he only wobbled limply to her touch. She picked up his glaive from next to him, still wet with undead entrails. It felt like a large branch of a tree of metal, but she took a practiced swing through the air, and it suddenly felt as light as her own arms. She swung it again, this time aiming for the neck of an ill-fated Esperite that was almost on its feet, and the head went rolling. Another came toward her, and she plunged one end into its abdomen, but it pushed forward and clawed at her. The movement looked like a worthless grope, but when it touched her, the finger's flesh sloughed away, leaving just claws of sharp bone. It ripped into her, tearing away pieces of her leather shirt and a couple layers of skin. A third zombie came at her from the left, and it clawed at her as well, but she ducked her shoulder to dodge and pulled up on the glaive, opening a huge gash in the impaled zombie's side. Its torso slipped off halfway, and the mismatched weight carried it down. A fourth zombie clawed at her back, falling onto her as it did so. Kathy dropped the glaive to catch her fall. She moved to grab it again, but the zombie that had fallen onto her bit down at her shoulder, and she snapped around to avoid the bite's full impact. The third zombie fell onto her as well, and she could feel the whole horde of them moving toward her and leaning down on her to join the mass. Kathy felt one begin to bite her, and she pulled her leg out of its mouth. She tried to kick, but from the ground she had no leverage, and the zombie's weight on top of her held her down. She couldn't see out through the undead piled on top of her, and bites and claws were coming from all directions. She struggled and writhed, flailing to no avail. She tried to recoil from every bite and claw, but she could hardly move, and she wondered whether she'd suffocate first or be torn to bits. "Sivian!" she called, but she couldn't even know he could hear her. She wondered consciously if she'd ever killed someone when she was a werewolf, a thought she'd kept suppressed from the time she'd met Sevian until now. She wondered if they felt as she did now. But no, she wouldn't die this way. Would a werewolf succumb to a few zombies? She was stronger than that. Kathy grabbed the first handhold she could find among the mass of undead. She pulled, twisted, and ripped whatever it was, and she felt it tear away. She let go and grabbed two more handfuls of undead flesh, one with each hand, and she repeated even as she kicked her legs and twisted under the writhing mass to keep any bites from digging too deep. Her hands were slimy with rot, but she took two more handfuls, and one of them was cold metal. She ripped away both pieces again, and from her right, where she'd pulled away the metal, she felt one zombie stop moving. She moved her right arm within her limited space, using the filigree ethereum as a weapon to slice more chunks away. She twisted and pulled wherever she could reach her arm, and one by one the bodies on top of her stopped moving. Kathy pulled herself out of the pile, counted seven undead and now inanimate heads, and tossed away the ethereum neck she found herself holding onto. No more zombies remained. Anstrom still lay unconscious, and across the room, Sevian was performing some arcane wizard's fight against Ulquart. In front of Ulquart floated the orb. And as he directed with his hands, narrow blasts of the gray-purple glow shot toward Sevian. The white-haired man's eyes were tightly shut, but he matched every motion of Ulquart's hands with motions of his own, and each time the gray-purple blast that was sent forward was dispersed by a force field that appeared as a blue ripple in the otherwise unperturbed air. "I need a distraction," Sevian said, though his mouth hadn't moved, and Gathy realized it had only been in her head. "Stay out of this, you little Cathari-dropping..." Ulquart yelled, though Gathy did see his mouth move, and while he neither diverted his concentration from the mage battle nor moved to face her, Gathy assumed the comment was meant for her. She overturned an Esperite corpse and retrieved Anstrom's double-sided glaive. It was heavy again, but she turned it over in her hands, swung a couple practice strikes, and pulled it back like a javelin. She took a few short lunges toward the stairs and let the glaive fly up toward Ulquart, but the boy necromancer turned toward her, glaring. With one hand, he shot a gray-purple burst of energy at her from the orb, and he turned his other hand up in front of the oncoming glaive. Gathy's heart skipped a beat as the shadowy energy flew toward her, but it stopped in front of the same kind of blue ripple that Sevian had used to protect himself. Ulquart screamed in pain, and Gathy looked up to see him with the glaive penetrating his left palm and pinning him to the cave wall. A second later, the black-haired younger brother fell unconscious, his limp weight splitting his hand on the glaive's blade between the two fingers and pulling him down the stairs. Sevian opened his eyes and took a deep breath. "I was in his head to counter every strike of the orb, but he was firing so quickly I didn't have time to delve deeper and knock him out. Good work." Gathy smiled and nodded. Sevian looked her up and down and added, "You look awful." Gathy looked down at herself and reluctantly agreed. Her clothes were torn all over, showing patches of exposed, skinless flesh. Her foot wound throbbed, and every piece of her body was sore, whether from being crushed, bitten, or clawed. She let the adrenaline fade and fell onto her hands and knees to breathe deeply. On Innistrad, a bite from a vampire could mean becoming one, and she'd heard rumors the same could be true for graft crawlers. She hoped this was different. "Don't worry," Sevian said. "They are different. These people were only made into zombies by Ulquart's orb. It created a curse that infected all ethereum-infused humanoids for miles." Gathy looked up at Sevian from her place on the ground. "How many times do I have to tell ye to stay out of my head?" Sevian smiled. "Sorry, I was just in the boy's mind for several minutes. The spell lingers. Let me do one thing before it wears off." Gathy eyed him warily, but Sevian turned to the unconscious older brother, whose eyes immediately shot open, and he sat up with a jolt and looked around. "Good morning, Anstrom." "Ulquart!" "He's alive, but he may require some tending to." Anstrom ran over to his brother at the bottom of the stairs and checked his pulse, then put his ethereum arm on Ulquart's torn hand. White light emerged again inside Anstrom's ethereum elbow, and it spiraled down his forearm, onto his hand, and into his brother's hand. In a few seconds, the blood stopped flowing as the wound closed, though the hand was left looking like a claw, with the two smaller fingers separated from the rest of the hand by a deep wedge. "He'll be judged by the sphinxes." Anstrom hung his head. "I doubt the events here will go unnoticed by them for long." Sevian sat cross-legged on the altar with the ethereum orb hovering between his hands. "This will all be over soon, Anstrom," he said solemnly. Instrom walked over to Kathy and knelt next to her. He put his white glowing hand on her face, and she felt some wound she didn't know she had, as her skin stitched up around it and turned cool. "This is one of the things I learned here," he said. "The magic of Grixis never suited me." Kathy moved her hand to her face and took Anstrom's hand in hers, then moved it to her waist as she moved in to hug him. "Thank you," she said softly in his ear, and she kissed him lightly on the cheek. She leaned back and looked at Anstrom, and he was looking right back at her and smiling. Deep breath. And while they spent most of their couple days with Sevian dragging Gathy to Ethersworn Visitariums to learn more about and the mask's mouth moved as the Sphinx foot. What's going on? Whoops, that's not the right accent. The puppeteer zombie put one foot over the edge of the railing. Avacyn's bloody wing. Whoops. Ew. Break time. Do you know these graph crawlers? 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 Do you know? Do you know? Mrech. Anstrom stopped walking. So, the red-haired girl stated. Whew. Only 15 pages ago. That was you? I couldn't breathe, you rot-brain fool. It wasn't often he couldn't figure something out. Anstrom glapped. I don't know. Sevian stepped back from the sudden commotion and gathered mana. Never pay the scholar, they say, Anstrom said. Just kidding. That's the wrong line. Sephiroth, wall. Near. Sephiroth, wall. But Sevian put both. Typo. Whoa. Typo again. Ew.